Luke chapter 6, beginning to read at verse 12. In those days, Jesus went to a mountainside to pray and spent the whole night praying to God. When morning came, he called his disciples to him and chose 12 of them, whom he also designated apostles. Simon, whom he renamed Peter, his brother Andrew, James, John, Philip, Bartholomew, Matthew, Thomas, James, son of Alphaeus, Simon, who was called the Zealot, Judas, son of James, and Judas Iscariot, who became a traitor. Have you ever wondered why Jesus chose the particular range of blokes that he did to share his life with and tour with and train up and send out into the world as his deputies? The brothers Simon, Peter, and Andrew. The sons of thunder, James and John, who regarded themselves as the important ones and the ones who wouldn't tolerate any dissent. Philip, the guy who asks all the questions. Plain-talking Nathaniel. And all six of those already connected through the Galilean fishing industry. They all knew each other and possibly had been mates with Jesus all their lives. And we see in the Gospels Jesus going around with them to social events on one occasion. We see in John chapter 2 before he calls his 12 and designates his apostles. Where do we get to in that list? That was the first six, and they're always named together. And then we've got Levi, or Matthew, the sellout public servant, kowtowing to Rome, and his brothers James and Thomas the skeptic. We've got Simon the, we presume, anti-Roman activist. We've got Judas, son of James, and Judas Iscariot the traitor. A range of blokes, aged from their teens to around 30, we think. No scope for friction there, then. Well, I don't know. I think put the four businessmen in a room with the tax collector for the Romans, you might have the potential for a few colorful conversations at the dinner table. Or put the tax collector for the Romans in a confined space with the anti-Roman activist. I think they'd have some fiery conversations. Some sparks might fly there. Or put the traitor in a room with 10 guys who history tells us were prepared to go to the stake for Jesus. I reckon there'd be some tension there. Well, they have certain things in common. They're all young Jewish guys. But there's enough diversity there. There's enough separating them to make for some interesting times on the road. And in fact, when we read the Gospels, that's exactly what we see. The Gospel writers don't hide from us something of the friction and fireworks that happened among them. So why did Jesus put those guys together? Had he not heard of the homogeneous unit growth principle? Which, in case you don't know, it's a phrase from church growth literature that says that churches grow faster when the people in them are all very similar to each other. Can we have the second slide? Or perhaps it was that Jesus held to the wisdom of this old English nursery rhyme. If you can't read the writing, it says, Jack Sprat could eat no fat, his wife could eat no lean, and so between the two of them, they licked the platter clean. Perhaps that's how Jesus saw it. These were complementary giftings he was pulling together. Perhaps Jesus saw every personality, every eccentricity as expressing something of God, and that put together it would be a full picture. That was relevant to our conversation just earlier, wasn't it? You don't have to nod. Perhaps that's what made it fun for Jesus. Even if sometimes he found he had to step in and say, "Children, children," which is what he called them a number of times through the Gospels. But I wonder if maybe Jesus illustrated this kind of range for his core group to illustrate these things on slide 3. These are some of the one another teachings of the New Testament. Teachings with each other or one another in them. Perhaps it's that the apostles or their writers wrote these after the experience of living and touring together for 3 years and working out what that required. Or perhaps they wrote these after the experience of collaborating as partners in mission for the next 30 years and worked out these are the things that requires. There are 59 one another teachings in the New Testament, and many others that, without using that phrase, are really teaching the same thing. And what we have on this slide is just a selection. Be at peace with each other. Wash one another's feet. Be devoted to one another in brotherly love. Live in harmony with one another. Stop being judgy about each other. Carry each other's burdens. Be patient, bearing with one another in love, forgiving each other. Be humble towards each other. In humility, consider others more important than yourselves. Forgive whatever grievances you may have against one another. Teach and admonish one another. Build each other up. Encourage one another daily. Spur one another on toward love and good deeds. Don't badmouth each other. Don't moan about each other. Confess your sins to each other. Love one another deeply from the heart. Live in harmony with one another. Offer hospitality to one another without grumbling. And love one another. And that exact phrase, love one another, comes 15 times in the New Testament. Although really that's what the whole list is unpacking, isn't it? Love one another. Clearly, the apostles found that was what was needed for 3 years in Jesus' small group. Now, to do any of this stuff, the one another stuff of the New Testament, you have to be part of a group of some kind. You can't do it on your own. You can't carry one another's burdens or bear with one another if there's only one of you. Unless you're a very difficult person, of course. You can't do a one another if there's only one of you. Or on the other hand, if you only ever engage with big church and the big meeting, you can, if you want to, avoid doing any of the things on that list. That's not a piece of advice. It's an observation. But group life, that's to say small group where everybody knows each other, where we get a bit closer, where it's not as easy to hide, a small group asks these things of you. And it's doing these things that actually changes us. A few years ago, Ruth and I served as regional contact people for a ministry called Oikos Australia. And that organization exists to support and encourage small grassroots expressions of church. And often these small, organic, micro churches are fairly independent, and they don't want to be hijacked or branded or turned into something they don't want to be. But from time to time, they want some of the value of being in association with others. And from time to time, we would find that they would reach out and make contact with us at Oikos. And often they did so after they'd been going for a while. Usually, when they'd been getting to know each other for about 18 months or so, and had begun really getting to know each other and bumping up against each other, and were now having to do some of the harder stuff on that list. Being part of an intentional small group requires these things of you, and it knocks the edges off you a bit, and it teaches you heaps about people and about yourself. Group life adds another layer of accountability in your journey with God, in your journey of growth, and your journey with people. Now, on that topic, the accountability topic, does anyone here own a Justin Bieber t-shirt? Yeah, that's disappointing. I couldn't get hold of one that was, for a bloke of my build. Just to explain the connection, this is part of my accountability. I'm not coming out as a Justin Bieber fan. Please relax. It's part of my accountability to the small group that I'm a part of. Because in our small group, I set a goal, it's a very good goal, of a certain frequency of exercise each week. That's swimming and gymming to keep me fit. And for one reason or another, I haven't made my goal several months in a row. And having to wear an I'm a Belieber t-shirt is my penalty. It is the hat of shame that my group has chosen for me. It's the equivalent of being put in the stocks, isn't it? And having rotten tomatoes thrown at you. It's worse, isn't it? It's my reminder to keep me accountable to my goal and to my group. Thank you, Steve. I was going to say, if I haven't made my goal in the next week or two, I will be needing one, so see me afterwards if you can access one. One time I was part of a small group where spurring one another on to love and good deeds was something we did very intentionally every week when we sat down and ate together. It was part of our shared commitment in that group to be looking each week in our scattered lives for opportunities to share the love of Jesus and share the gospel with people. And we set up 5 of these groups in our little network. And just because it was part of our conversation intentionally every week, we saw people from outside our groups coming to faith. Friends and family members in the first year of every one of those groups. Simply because that new layer of accountability and that kind of thinking together and that kind of encouragement meant that we each actually got around to doing things and connecting with people and having conversations in ways that we'd been meaning to do for ages but just hadn't quite got around to. We just needed that bit of spurring on to get around and do it. In that first small group that Jesus ran, Jesus worked on the 12. So there was a before and after as a consequence of being in that group. And the before and after change impacted others in turn. we know it changed the world. Some years ago, I had a dream. Now, I know not every dream is significant. Some dreams you have because you ate too much cheese before you went to bed, or watched too much CSI, or you slept in a draft, but this was not that kind of dream. It was amazingly coherent and amazingly vivid. And the dream began with what was like a God's eye view over North America and Great Britain. And could we have slide 4, Vanessa? Thank you. And across the two land masses, I could see tens of thousands of believers pouring out their zeal and love and worship of God. It was the 1700s, and there'd been a massive revival spanning the Atlantic. And I was catching a God's eye view of the aftermath from the heavenlies. And then in the dream, we went back a little further in time. And again, looking down across that part of the West, I could see pockets of revival. I could see what they used to call field meetings, or what today we would call camps, or festivals, or conferences. And I could see people riding out from those across the land and carrying the fire of revival with them to other places. And then in the dream, we went further back in time again. And I could see a few groups just here and there, groups of people being taught and equipped in the things of God and in the Holy Spirit. And then we went further back, and we were in a room, a student's room in a college in Oxford, as three students prayed together and made a pledge together to be accountable to one another and spur each other on as ambassadors of the gospel. And they made a commitment together to get holy in every way they could think. The students' names were William Morgan, Charles Wesley, and John Wesley. Can we have slide 5, please? And the group meeting in that student's room was called the Holy Club. It was later joined by George Whitfield, whose name you might know, and a number of others. Now, I should say that I did know that history before I had the dream, but it was like I was watching a documentary that had been made just for me to remind me that this enormous culture-changing revival of the 1700s began in a room when three students made an agreement together to press into the things of God. That was the significance of what happened among those three young students. Now, the size of that group, three people, would seem unpromising. What can three people do? But numbers are not the key to power. Jesus said, whenever two or three are gathered in my name, there I am among them. I always think Jesus sounds a bit indecisive in that verse. Whenever two, or maybe three, but it's not a big number, are gathered, there I am, the source of revival, the source of a power that shifts cultures from generation to generation, from century to century. Numbers are not the key to power, and the most powerful spiritual encounter ever I had in my life was made not in a big conference, not in a congregational meeting, but praying with one other person. So it does work with two. Numbers are not the key to power. the God we're in touch with is the key to power. So though the size of that group seemed unpromising, three people, it was what happened in that group that made the difference. It's what Jesus did in that group, what they allowed him to do with them in that group that made the difference. Because in that small group, the Spirit of Jesus did a work on those three people. There was a before and an after. And because of the before and after, many others were impacted. And though the group was never more than 25 in number, what happened to the people in the group changed the world, changed world history. In our pattern of life today, in Australia, 250 years later, half a world away, we're still feeling the after effects of the revival that resulted from that small group in that student's room. I wonder where your focus lies in church life. I wonder what you look to as your hope, as a release of greater power. What's your hope for that? Where do you most easily imagine it? Do you imagine that it might be in what you do with one or two other people? Now, not every small group follows a trajectory like that of the Holy Club, necessarily. And what you want or need from group life may vary from season to season, just as the scripture says, for everything there is a season. So you are allowed to move around and try different things. I was reading a survey of small groups the other day written by an Italian research student, and he identified three kinds of groups. This is slide six. Three kinds of groups: Girovaggi, Sarabiti, and Cenobiti. I have no idea what they mean, but I looked them up. And just in case you're not familiar with those words either, Girovaggi refers to groups of people who are just looking. There's no commitment involved. They're just there to get a flavor of the church to decide if it might be for them. And then secondly, Sarabiti, these are groups of people who meet for fellowship, but without really getting to grips with one another or with God sufficiently for their lives to change as a result of being in that group. And the writer was a bit dismissive of those. And then thirdly, Cenobiti. These are groups with an agreed purpose, a commitment to each other, agreed patterns of group life that put the group on a journey. And lives change as a result of what they do together. And that was the kind of group that this student was looking for himself. Can we have slide seven? He was writing this article in the 500s AD. And his name was Benedict of Nursia, or Saint Benedict for short. And his groups changed the world too. Now, there are many different ways you can build the one another stuff into your life. You may be in a family or a friendship group or a life group or a ministry group or a task group that provides the one another stuff for you. Some people here at YVV do it in weekly groups. Some of us here do it in groups that meet fortnightly. Some of us in groups that meet monthly. Some of us are in groups that meet for a season, that follow courses and run for just a limited period. And all those are legitimate ways of doing it. All those are ways we can share the journey together and experience a before and an after. But if you're not in such a group at the moment, if you're not in a life group or any other kind of group that does these things, and if you find that you can't accommodate a weekly life group commitment, and if you'd like to experiment with something that's really geared for the overscheduled person, I don't know if we have any such people here this morning, then you're very welcome to borrow the pattern that I'm following with my little group. It involves high commitment, but not a heavy commitment. We meet once a month as a micro group. I do it with two groups, a group of two and a group of three each month. And the agreement we've made is to spur one another on in the way of love. That's love for God, love for people, love for His gospel. To spur one another on in the way of simplicity. That's simplifying our lifestyle so we have enough energy to engage with people and the things of God. To spur one another on in the way of worship. That means loving and knowing Jesus and following Him onto new territory. And to spur one another on in the way of soul friendship, deepening our connection, because it's in that kind of relationship that often we do our deepest work. And we call it the simple rule. And that's our accountability, the accountability we've agreed with one another. And each time we gather, we take a tool from our toolbox and use it to dig a little deeper and work on one of those four areas in our life. And it's really a pared back version of a rule of life that I've followed for a number of years. To try it out, all you need is a bit of hunger and the toolbox, which looks like this. And then all you need is one or two or three people to do it with. The number's not the key thing, remember. It's what you allow Jesus to do with you when you gather, how deep you're prepared to go with one another. So if that is of interest to you, if you have a gap in your life or something like that, just tap me on the shoulder afterwards and I'll talk with you further. But whatever kind of small group you are in or joining, I want to encourage you about the importance of what you're doing. Can we have slide 8, please? Because when we come together intentionally to do the one another stuff of the New Testament, we're stirring up what God has put in us. When we gather to do these things intentionally, we are fanning the flames that fuel what we do when we're scattered in the world, carrying His love, living it out, and impacting others. Let's stand and pray together.